We got a bunch of things to talk about. We've got the State of the Union. We'll talk about the State of the Union preview. I will watch it. I'll comment on it next time. If there's, I don't know that there'll be anything worth saying. But I just want to, one of the things that I expect Joe Biden to say is something he's been saying on the campaign trail forever, really. And all the Democrats say, and it's a really stupid argument, but it works with people who don't follow the news, and it's parroted by like the Morning Joe crowd, the MSNBCs of the world, and it is this idea that it is not, this Republican Party is not your father's Republican Party. And it's just accepted. The other day, the Washington Post had a piece about how the defeat of and the exit of what's-her-face, Nikki Haley, see, I've already forgotten, means that this is, you know, it's an end of the Reaganism of the Republican Party. It's not your Republican Party. It's not your father's Republican Party anymore. As though Reagan couldn't get nominated today. And you really have to ask, how is it? Why is it? Why would anybody think that Reagan couldn't get nominated today? Ronald Reagan was pro-life. The Republican Party is pro-life. Ronald Reagan was pro-strong national defense. The Republican Party is pro-strong national defense. What is it? Where is it that the Republican Party in the minds of these people in the media has changed? Where's it gone? Where is it different? They don't ever have an answer because they don't say, I believe this is happening and here I'm going to make a case. They simply declare it to be and go about their business as though everybody in the room just kind of nods and goes, yep, no, it's right. It's not the Republican Party of old. Nobody ever asks how. But is it the Democratic Party of old? Is this your, I guess if it's not your father's Republican Party, is this your mother's Democratic Party? I don't really think so. I don't really think so at all. And I actually, unlike these people who simply declare things to be, have some receipts. And it goes in the form of, sorry, I hit the microphone. It goes in the form of Bill Clinton. It's not that long. 1995 is not all that long ago. It's really not. It is a world of difference when it comes to politics, when it comes to the Democratic Party. But if you look at, like, Aaron Blake, who writes for the Washington Post, he's allegedly a reporter at the Washington Post, or staff writer. His headline was, Haley exits the race and proves the Reagan GOP is no more. Go, huh. What? How is this? What case? Because I'm interested in these sorts of things. What case is he making that the Reagan GOP is no more? And so you read it. And it takes quite a while to get around to his thesis, to his series. Welcome to the campaign moment, where the last major non-Trump and non-Biden candidate is now out. Today is the moment. Today, the key moment is Nikki Haley dropping out of the presidential race this morning after Super Tuesday and effectively bringing the Republican primary contest to an end. Haley announced her exit, blah, 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 and you get it, paragraph 5. No mention of anything. It mentions that Mitch McConnell has endorsed Donald Trump because he's the only game in town. Of course, McConnell's a Republican, blah, blah, blah. We now move into what is likely to be an expensive, incredibly vicious, and prolonged general election slugfest between a president and a former president. But before we turn the page, let's look at the Republican battle, and specifically Haley's candidacy and what it taught us. Okay, maybe we're getting around to it. It's been clear for a while that Haley wasn't going to win the nomination. But she nevertheless stuck it out for a longer period of time than candidates in her position usually do. In doing so, she gave us very important information about the state of her party. How? She'd already lost. She'd lost. He's admitting, look, she lost. And she lost a long time ago. So what do you learn from somebody who lost a long time ago? It's not never give up. Sometimes you have to abandon ship. When you're neck deep in water, it's time to get on the lifeboat. But let's see, what does he say? It's been clear for a while that Haley wasn't going to, well, blah, 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 blah. In doing so, she gave us very important information about her party. With Trump racking up win after win, the writing has been on the wall for weeks for Haley's exit, and she all but acknowledged her campaign was about making a point rather than actually winning. Okay, we're now halfway through the piece. Have you heard anything about Reagan? Have you heard anything about the past? No. That point, colon, Donald Trump is a liability for my party, and I'm going to prove it. Ultimately, Haley's campaign mostly served a somewhat different but valuable purpose, showing how much of today's Republican Party is defined by Trump and has little use for traditional conservatism. Ooh, maybe we're going to get a, maybe we're going to get an argument. Haley's campaign gave us a pretty direct test that has eluded us previously. What would happen if voters were faced with a one-on-one choice between Trump and the GOP of yesteryear? Now, how does Nikki Haley represent the GOP of yesteryear? Haley exuded, he says, the Reagan and George W. Bush eras. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more prototypical standard-bearer, conservative but pragmatic, fiscally conscious, hawkish on issues like Russia and Ukraine, and uninterested in the right wing's almost singular focus on provocation. What? That's the a singular focus on provocation. What is it, provocation about? What is it, just walking around to people and giving everybody wet willies? Is it giving out the nerds, you know, wedgies in the lunch line? Provocation, what? Haley declined to try to reinvent herself, even when it was clear her approach wasn't working. And when she got grief from Never Trumpers and the left for not adopting their approach, that at least left us with a truer test of where the GOP stands. Her primary loss shows the direction the GOP wanted to go, and it wasn't Haley's, Bush's, or Reagan's. Now, that's the end of the argument. How did Aaron Blake make the case that Nikki Haley's anything like Ronald Reagan, and that the loss of Nikki Haley was a rejection of Reaganism? Well, they're pragmatic. What does that mean, pragmatic? How? On what? Personally? The only difference is that, you know, the old GOP used to roll over. That's what the left likes. That's what this is really all about. They used to get a big old smack in the face, a punch in the face, right in the nose, right in the jaw. And then the immediate reaction of the Republican establishment was, I'm sorry about that. Is your hand okay? Should I get you some ice as their nose bleeds? That's the GOP that the left romanticizes. Of course, Ronald Reagan was never anything like that. He hit back in a way that nobody else has really hit back since then, with humor and humility. And, you know, you'd watch somebody get beat up, not even beat up. Reagan was too smart to get beat up, but somebody take a punch, and then Reagan would turn the crowd against the person who threw it. George W. Bush didn't do that very much. George H.W. Bush, they called a wimp. The guy's a World War II hero, former head of the CIA. And he was portrayed as a wimp. That's what they like. That's how they like their GOP. They like people who are, oh, sorry about that. I hope I don't offend you with my beliefs. And if I do, I'll be very pragmatic. I'll help vote for you. I'll do this. I'll give you this, that, and the other thing. Just be nice to me. I don't think Aaron Blake has any idea what Reaganism was. I don't think he has any idea what conservatism is. He has the understanding of Republicans that somebody would have of a tiger if they watched one in a zoo for 20 minutes. That's how they view us. That's how they view anybody who isn't them. Some sort of weird experiment. It needs to keep an eye on it, keep it at a distance, but don't really engage it. But it's somehow Republicans have changed. Ronald Reagan gave Democrats hell. He gave it hell with a smile. In that sense, things have changed. Republicans no longer do it with a smile. You need a certain type of personality to do it with a smile, to be honest with you. You need to be able to kill with kindness, death by a thousand cuts. The modern Republican Party, the end result is still you get your ass kicked. But the modern Republican Party takes a punch and goes, all right, I'm gonna beat the hell out of you. All right, I'm going to go at you the way you're coming at me. And then the left is like the bully in A Christmas Story. Used to picking on everybody. You're going to cry, Ralphie, you're going to cry. And then Scott Farkas gets his. Ralphie starts beating the hell out of him. He doesn't know what to do. He starts crying. He runs away. His little henchman runs away. That's the Democratic Party. It's how they always were. Republicans used to be able to get by with the killing them with kindness. But times have changed. Styles have changed. And it changed, you know when it changed. It changed in 2016. Donald Trump showed there's another way. There's a more effective way. And quite frankly, it's a much more satisfying way. Sick of the Marcus of Queensbury rules in a fight against somebody with a switchblade and a chain and a pipe and a baseball bat. Sick of that. So a lot of us are sick of that. But you look at the modern Republican Party on issues, it has not changed. Now I want to play you something that definitely shows the difference between the two parties. Bill Clinton, 1995, not that long ago, really not that long ago, a very popular president. It's amazing how this guy's still popular. Like, there's serious allegations against him. There's serious proof against him. And the Me Too movement, he survived all that. And he's still a Democrat in good standing because ultimately they only distance themselves from Bill for as long as they absolutely needed to because they're insincere about all this stuff. But Bill Clinton, William Jefferson Clinton, during his State of the Union address, brought up illegal aliens. Now, keep in mind, the liberal media and Joe Biden, same thing, different jobs, are insisting that the Republican Party has changed. They are so radical now, but they don't really say on what. But they're so radical now that it's not your father's Republican Party. Tell me, given what Joe Biden has done on the southern border, given what every single Democrat supports on the southern border, given what MSNBC routinely spouts about the southern border, does this at all sound like your mom's Democrat Party from 1995?
All Americans, not only in the states most heavily affected, but in every place in this country, are rightly disturbed by the large numbers of illegal aliens entering our country. The jobs they hold might otherwise be held by citizens or legal immigrants. The public service they use impose burdens on our taxpayers. That's why our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more by hiring a record number of new border guards, by deporting twice as many criminal aliens as ever before, by cracking down on illegal hiring, by barring welfare benefits to illegal aliens. In the budget I will present to you, we will try to do more to speed the deportation of illegal aliens who are arrested for crimes, to better identify illegal aliens in the workplace, as recommended by the commission headed by former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation of laws. It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
I could have given that speech. Donald Trump could have given that speech. The delivery wouldn't have been quite as good in either case, but the substance would have been exactly the same. Could anybody in the Democratic Party give a speech similar to that? Forget that speech. Similar to that today. Yet somehow it is the Republican Party that has changed. So dramatically different are we that it's not Reagan's Republican Party. They never tell you how, because they're lying. That's how they make everything. They simply declare something to be. And they don't back it up because they don't have to back it up. Normally, in a good publication, an editor would come back and say, you know, your headline and your thesis, which first of all, you take 15 paragraphs to get to your thesis and your headline. But you don't back it up. You don't make an argument. You just say, well, she's pragmatic and blah, blah. Okay. What about, you know, she's pragmatic. Okay. You could say that Donald Trump is impulsive. But I don't really see that. That's more of a style thing. Pragmatism and impulsive are more style things when you go into the issues. Is the Republican Party pro-life? Yeah, they are. Is the Republican Party pro-traditional family? Yeah. Is pro, where? Now, show me in the past where the Democratic Party said, you don't even have to go back to the Clinton years. You can go back to the Obama years. Don't have to go get in the Wayback Machine that far. Show me in the Obama years where the Democratic Party said, go ahead, slice off parts of little kids and give them hormones and give them all sorts of drugs. And let's just see what happens. People forget it wasn't until 2012 that the Democratic Party came out in favor of gay marriage. And the only reason they did it was for fundraising purposes. I'm not saying they were opposed to gay marriage. When they were opposed to gay marriage, they weren't opposed to gay marriage. I don't think they were necessarily in favor of gay marriage when they came out in favor of gay marriage. They were in favor of the fundraising from the gay community that they traditionally got that Obama wasn't getting at the time, which miraculously came back. I think they just didn't give a damn about it one way or the other. I think most people who had opinions on it didn't really give a damn about it one way or the other. Personally, I opposed it because of the way that it was implemented. It was simply decreed by the mayor of San Francisco, now the governor, and the Supreme Court of Massachusetts to be like, oh, we didn't see this hidden thing in there. No, that's not how it's weird. Coming from the party of this is what democracy looks like, they don't ever really implement their ideals through the process of democracy. I had a problem with the redefining of words based on the political conveniences and beliefs at the moment. I couldn't care less about the other implications of it. I wasn't married at the time. I wasn't really thinking about getting married at the time. But that was a pretty dramatic change from the Democratic Party of the past. Bill Clinton, Mr. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where do you think he would have fallen? The Defense of Marriage Act, all those Democrats who voted for it. Now suddenly they're in favor of poly relationships and genital mutilation of children and everything. And like, huh, is that your father's Democratic Party? Because I can promise you that the old Republican Party would have been just as against genital mutilation as it is now. So again, not a change. The Democrats have changed. Weird, isn't it? All the radicalism is coming from the left, and all the crying about how radical a political party is directed toward the right. You're sitting on a bench, and I've said this before, you're sitting on a bench in the middle of the bench, and you slide way down away from the other person. Now, from your perspective, that person's way far away from you now. We used to be so close. What happened? You went so far. No, you moved. I'm still sitting in the same seat. It's much easier to make the argument that the other person moved, because then you can frame the movement as evil and you don't have to defend your own evil movement. Make no mistake, that's what happened, and that's what's going to continue to happen. It is your father's Republican Party. It's the traditional Republican Party because it's based on the Constitution and rooted in individual rights and individual liberty to do what you want to do, but not be forced to do what you don't want to do. The left is the exact opposite of that. They used to be pro-American. Do you think they are today? All righty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It is the Derek Hunter Podcast for the 8th of March, 2024. Happy, glorious Friday. It is the day after the State of the Union, but it's really recorded the day of the State of the Union. It's the miracle of time. It's confusing. And honestly, is Joe Biden, if you think back on it, if you watch the damn thing, did he say anything worth a damn? If he did, I'll talk about it on the Weekend F and Review or on Monday or whatever. But I can lie to myself. I don't need the president of the United States to do it. But I'd rather he do that than any of the other crap he's trying to do. So, I mean, it's a balancing act. Anyway, welcome to the show. Don't forget about the Weekend F and Review, patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast or DerekHunter.locals.com. Be posted at midnight tonight. It's a great way to show support for the program. It's the only way, actually, unless it's like moral support. But other support, real tangible support at $5 a month goes a long, long way to keeping the show going, honestly. So thank you for that. All right. Enough business. Let's get down to business so we can get down to the business of the weekend. So I'm looking at Facebook here while I'm doing the show, and I see my sister posts, she reposts things. Lefties constantly. She's the only one in the family who's a lefty. And she posts things like this all the time. And you just sit there and you go, what are you doing? What are you doing? And it's always somebody reposting. She's reposting somebody. She's smart, too. Not as smart as me, but she's smart. And anytime you see the word inflation in the news, replace it with record-breaking corporate profits. Yeah, that's it. It's inflation. That's all it is. It's just greedy corporations. It's straight out of the DNC. It's straight out of the White House. It's straight out of fantasy land. It doesn't make any sense. Sorry, sis, but it's just not true. The inflation index is not based upon evil corporate profits, right? You can say, well, corporate profits are up. Well, yeah, corporate profits are up. Again, if you control the unit of measure, you control everything. In raw dollars, corporate profits are up. Because if you were selling something for a dollar last year, and now you're selling it for $2, and let's just say you sold a million of them, so you had $1 million last year. This year, you sell a million of them, you got $2 million. My God, and they're just assuming it's all profit. We're doing basic math here. This is fantasy land, remember. Oh, my God, their profits have doubled. Doubled, and it's greedy. That's why it doesn't cost $2 more. They're just making greedy. They're using the cover of the concept of inflation to try and cover for their own corporate greed. Well, things cost more to make whatever it is you're selling for a dollar. And the value of the dollar is dropped significantly, right? The buying power of that dollar, the $2, is what a dollar was a year ago. So in raw numbers, my God, they're making more money because things cost more than they were before. And, well, profit is different than cost. Yeah, it is. But the value of the dollar, the purchasing power of the dollar, is what's impacted by inflation. That's what inflation is. So less purchasing power and having more dollars doesn't really matter. If inflation were 10% and you got a 5% raise, you would be essentially getting a 5% pay cut. Right? That's just how it works, even though you're getting more money than you were before, right? Or if inflation were 10% and you got a 20% raise, you're not getting a 20% raise, really. Your buying power is only increased 10%. Why, you're making record profits. But when inflation was 2%, you had much better quality of life. You were able to afford things much easier, even making less money. It's all a game that you can play with math. Anybody can do it. If you choose to look, what I forget what I wrote this in the Hill. I might have mentioned it on the show, but I wrote this in the Hill newspaper about a month ago. The Monty Python, the foot, you know, everybody knows the foot that comes out and splats everything. It's part of a painting, a very famous medieval painting. And it's just a tiny part of this famous medieval painting. Why? Because that's all that Terry Gilliam wanted. That's all that he needed, was this tiny little piece of this foot. Now, there it is. It's like a bunch of cherubs and angels around a naked woman. And right down in the bottom left-hand corner is this foot. Terry Gilliam cut that foot out and ignored the rest of it. It's a very famous painting. It's Bronzino, I think it is. Yeah, I'm not. It's an Italian dude. But it was just that tiny little corner of the piece. Now, you would never know that. You would never know that. You think it's just some foot somebody drew or whatever, because that's all the Monty Python people showed you. If all you see is little bits and pieces of things, you'll never know the whole. Bronzino's mannerist masterpiece, an allegory with Venus and Cupid, made in the 1500s for King Francis I. The piece hangs large alongside the works of Michelangelo and Raphael, depicting with great detail the texture, Cupid, great detail and texture, Cupid kissing his mother Venus. You can find it, Google it yourself. You just put Monty Python foot in there, it comes up. That's all you'd know, because that's all they showed you. Well, if all they showed you was prices are up and corporate greed, then that's all you're going to know. That's all you're going to know. That's all they want you to know. Never trust anybody who doesn't show you the whole picture, or at least encourage you to go out and find the whole picture and make your own conclusions. If they're only showing you the foot, they're probably, well, Monty Python was doing it for comedic effect, but everybody else is doing it because they don't want you to know the cherubs. They don't want you to see Venus. They're hiding something from you. It's the business model from, say, what do you call it? MSNBC. They watch things so you don't have to. Well, really, they're watching things so you don't. They don't want you to. Let's shift gears here. Where do I want to go next? Let's go to CBS News reporting, because the left is telling you, again, the MSNBC gang the other day tried to tell you illegal alien crime. I don't see what the problem. Crime is not up. Crime is down. Crime is down because the reporting of crime is down. Why is the reporting of crime down? Because most people in major cities where they have progressive prosecutors recognize that, honestly, the prosecutors are not going to prosecute crime. So if somebody breaks into your car, somebody steals a bunch of shoplifting, whatever, there's no point in bothering calling the police. Out of frustration, you just throw up your hands and go, they're never going to bother with it. They're not going to do it. So why should I call the police? And so less crimes are reported, or fewer crimes are reported. But the crimes that you're going to need the police involved in, the violent crimes, the assault, the sexual crimes, the murder, those are all up across the board. It's referenced in this CBS News report about New York and the subway system. But they also repeat the lie that crime is down. crime isn't down. The reporting of crime is down. There's no point in reporting the crime if you know that it's going to fall on deaf ears. The cop sitting there going, and I told the story yesterday. Somebody broke into my car. Somebody tried to steal my car. There was literally no reason to tell the police about it. They weren't going to do anything. So somebody tried and failed to steal your car. What do I care? I couldn't. There was no point in telling the insurance company about it because, well, I didn't have that kind of coverage. I just had no fault. I didn't have collision. I didn't have property damage. I didn't have anything else. So there was no point. So that crime, for all intents and purposes, didn't exist. Shoplifting, for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist in these places. Well, shoplifting is way down. Really? I don't think. Then why is everything behind plexiglass? Why is it that we have massive amounts of surveillance footage of gangs of teens, they're always called, going into stores and walking out with armloads of things? Why is that? How is that? They don't ever talk about it. Listen to the CBS News report that things are, crime is way down, but for some weird reason, violent crime is up, and the governor is sending in the National Guard to New York City.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul's plan is aimed at improving subway rider safety, adding 1,000 more personnel, including 750 National Guard troops, to help with patrols and random bag searches.
Anyone looking to do harm or spread fear on our subways, you will be caught.
The move comes after a more than 46% spike in major crimes in the city's transit system in January compared to 2023. Across the country, CBS News polling shows crime is a top concern for voters. But data shows crime is down in big cities, including New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles.
In the daytime, I feel safe. Nighttime, I don't know, man. Because I be saying, where's the cops? You don't see them that much.
Already this year, there have been several high-profile crimes in New York's subway system, including three killings and a brutal attack on a conductor.
But you have to feel safe in the system, because I know how it plays on your psyche when you hear about some random acts of violence.
Danny Perlstein is with the transit advocacy group Riders Alliance.
With stationing troops there, that's going to create a heightened climate of fear of the subway. It's not getting at the root causes of the problems.
The governor's plan does include $20 million for mental health outreach.
In the morning, you see nothing but the homeless on the trains. I don't feel safe. Sometimes I just take the bus.
More than 3 million people ride the New York City transit system every day. But Nora, that is down from a peak of 5 million people per day before the pandemic.
All right, I know that's controversial. We'll be watching Elaine Cajano. Thank you.
Yeah, I know that's controversial. Why is it controversial? It's controversial in the circles in which you run, maybe, but it's not controversial in the grand scheme of life. Crime is up. No. Crime is actually down. No, it's not. It's what do you say? Well, crime's police statistics and blah, blah, blah. Then why is it that these liberals, the liberal governor of New York, is sending in the National Guard into the liberal city of New York City with the liberal mayor of New York City? None of them are going, wait a second, whoa, 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 whoa. I mean, the closest they had to a dissenting voice was the pasty 110-pound white liberal guy, consumer writer, advocate. It's just going to make people scared. Really? It's going to make people scared? Having police around makes people scared? Criminals. Yeah, but of course the left looks at black people as though they're infants, honestly. They're going to make minorities uncomfortable around police. No, I think when the defund police movement, all the white suburbanites are going, defund police, and the cities were defunding the police, and the black neighborhoods are going, don't, we want more police. What are you talking about? We want the police being around. When the police come around, the drug dealers scatter. There's not shootings in the street when the police come around. Oh, no. You don't understand. You don't understand the black experience, says the white suburbanite to the urban black man. You don't get it, old black lady. You're not woke. I'm woke. I know what's best for you. I've lived all of 25 years and racked up $250,000 in debt getting a gender and racial studies degree from an elite liberal university with a minor in lesbian dance. I obviously understand the black experience more so than you do, ma'am. Sit down and shut up and learn your place. I'm a Democrat. Now we go to the governor of New York, just to put a fine point on it, Kathy Hochul. She has to walk a delicate line. She recognizes the... See, the people who live in these cities recognize that violent crime is up, that crime is up. It's the liberals who live in the gated communities in the suburbs and the people who live in the doorman buildings, the Joy Reids of the world, who leave their building only via the garage in the backseat of a windowed, blacked-out town car. And they go to their friends, and the only interaction they have on the street is the 10 feet from the curb to the door that the doorman will open for them at their other building if they can't get access to the garage, right? Their groceries are delivered and put away by staff, so they don't really care and know what groceries cost. It doesn't matter. They've got money. They don't pay attention to such trivialities. They're the ones going, crime is, oh, this Republican myth of crime. Yeah, it's really easy. Go for a stroll in New York. Go for a stroll in New York after dark. See how that works out, Joy. Anyway, the governor is trying to please the Joy Reids of the world while also trying to remain politically viable without having the city collapse into the cesspool of illegal alien crime, drug use, homelessness. They're trying not to become San Francisco. And so she announced this yesterday.
I'm redeploying nearly 1,000 members of the New York State Police, MTA Police, and MTA National Guard to conduct bag checks in the city's busiest transits. You'll start seeing them at the tables, making sure that weapons are not being brought in, working in concert with our New York State Police, as well as our NYPD. Because no one heading to their job or to visit family or to go to a doctor appointment should worry that the person sitting next to them possesses a deadly weapon.
Yeah, that's the real problem. No, the real problem is people are beating the hell out of people. But she's got to use it as cover. She's trying to pretend that there's this scourge of guns, right-wingers carrying guns, on the subway. I guarantee, well, it's New York. Every gun is pretty much illegal. But the problem isn't people being shot, although it has happened. The problem is people being robbed. The problem is people being decked randomly for whatever reason. But she can't admit that. She has to try and couch it as, no, we're searching bags. We're doing this because of guns. We're worried about guns. That's what it is. It's about guns. Because then the left can't go, well, wait, we don't like guns. We don't like police, but we don't like guns. It confuses them. It's a fog that you spray. And then they go, all right, well, then forget it. We can go and do that. Now, let's get in the Wayback Machine to June 3rd, 2020. Senator Tom Cotton. Yes. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas wrote a piece in the New York Times called Send in the Troops. The subheadline, The Nation Must Restore Order. The Military Stands Ready. This was the summer of the BLM Antifa riots. St. George Floyd, never a better human being, has been birthed to another human being ever since Jesus. There's Jesus, and then we waited again as a species for perfection in George Floyd. And the whole gist of the piece is we need to dispatch the National Guard. These governors and the president, they need to dispatch the military to stop the burning of these cities, to stop the riots, to stop the murder, to stop the violence. We need to get control back, get order restored in these cities. And the left went absolutely crazy. The editorial page editor for the New York Times was ultimately fired for running an opinion piece, which was his job, because it offended the left-wing reporters at the New York Times. So much so that there's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraph editor's note that was added to the piece 2 days later while the guy was still scrambling to try and save his job rather than being principled. Said, after publication, this essay met strong criticism from many readers and many Times colleagues, prompting editors to review the piece and the editing process. Based on that review, we have concluded that the essay fell short of our standards and should not have been published. The basic arguments advanced by Senator Cotton, however objectionable people may find them, represent a newsworthy part of the current debate. But given the life and death importance of the topic, the senator's influential position, and the gravity of the steps he advocates, the essay should have undergone the highest level of scrutiny. Instead, the editing process was rushed and flawed, and senior editors were not sufficiently involved. While Senator Cotton and his staff cooperated fully with our editing process, the op-ed should have been subject to further substantial revisions, as is frequently the case with such essays, or rejected. For example, the published piece presents as fact assertions about the rules of cadres of left-wing radicals like Antifa. In fact, those allegations have not been substantiated and have been widely questioned. A bunch of lefties deny that they're a bunch of lefties. So we can't do that. That's the substantive thing. Antifa's out there bragging, they're carrying signs, they're wearing the uniforms, and like, well, they haven't been substantiated. We don't have answers to these questions that we've refused to ask. It's weird. Editors should have sought further corroboration of those assertions or removed them from the piece. The assertion that police officers, quote, bore the brunt of the violence is an overstatement that should have been challenged, too. Yeah. Police officers, they didn't. They had it easy. I mean, a couple of Molotov cocktails come their way every few minutes, and people with green lasers trying to blind them, bricks bouncing off their helmets and things like that. But boy, the brunt, let's not forget about, I don't know, who else would it be? Let's not forget about the store owners who had to board up their, no, they don't care about them either. The essay also included a reference to constitutional duty that was intended as a paraphrase. It should not have been rendered as a quotation. Beyond those factual questions, the tone of the essay in places is needlessly harsh and falls short of the thoughtful approach that advances useful debate. Don't you love it? He's too angry about all the murder and destruction. Editors should have offered suggestions to address those problems. The headline, which was written by the Times, not Senator Cotton, was incendiary and should not have been used. Finally, we failed to offer appropriate additional context, either in the text or the presentation, that could have helped readers place Senator Cotton's views within a larger framework of debate. That's a liberal scrambling to appease the left-wing mob, and there is no appeasing the left-wing mob. For one brief moment, that guy was a 1% enemy of the left. He's 1% deferred. He was 1% different from the left. He allowed somebody else to speak. And despite his years of indentured servitude to the progressive movement, he was thrown under the bus. He had to be destroyed because their 1% enemy is their 100% enemy. But now the governor and the mayor are like, please send in the National Guard. Where does Tom Cotton go to get his apology? Not the New York Times. Okay, now let us shift gears for a moment. Since we're ahead of the State of the Union address, I just want to play you Joe Scarborough. Joe vouching for Joe. Now, you've got to remember that Joe Scarborough has never mattered more in his life. He was a member of Congress, but he was an insignificant member of Congress. He wasn't in Congress all that long, and I think marital problems caused by him, as well as office problems, caused him to retire, quote unquote, retire. You know, and then he got a job at MSNBC, and it were all worked out for him. People fail up on the left. And he'll tell you, oh, he was super duper, pooper scooper conservative back in the day. And again, it's another example of, let's go back and look at Joe Scarborough's campaign in 1994 and compare that to Joe Scarborough of 2024. And go ahead and tell me how this isn't your father's Republican Party. I promise you, the current version of Joe Scarborough, I would say, would get into a fight, but he'd smack him. He'd slap him. It'd be a slap fight. It'd be kind of a joke, because the current version of Joe Scarborough is completely whipped by Mika, his third wife. And he's only her second husband. She might be the first husband have various parts of her body that have been augmented. I don't know the timeline there. All I know is that she's been dining out on her father's last name her whole life, because her accomplishments, other than being Zbigniew Brzezinski's daughter, is, I don't know. I don't know what her accomplishments are other than that. And it's weird because he came to prominence working for the Carter administration. Did I mention that liberals fail up? Because you'd, a normal human being in a just world where merit mattered would look at the Carter administration and everybody associated with it and go, we knew I'm not touching that. I gotta get away from that. Let's treat that like you just opened up the shed and some sort of woodland creature had died in there and just stunk. You just back away and you go, whoa. And all you hear is flies and your eyes start to water. And you go, I'm not going. We're going to let that air out for the next summer. You know, we're going to let that go. But instead, they all take care of their own, because failure is part of the problem. It's part of the plan for the left. Instead, they embrace it. So Zbigniew's kid became a media star because of merit. Anybody look at her and listen to her analysis or even her reading a teleprompter and think, yeah, there's nobody could do this better. Anybody? Like, wow, Mika is the top of that pyramid. No. No, there's just no way in God's green earth. It's because liberals take care of their own. Conservatives don't. Liberals do. One of the things we could learn from them. But on neither side does merit matter. But that's for another time. Anyway, Joe is out there trying to sell. Now, you've got to remember, all the stupid things that Morning Joe talks about, and we play them on this show, you hear them on other shows or whatever, they're not trying to convert anybody. Morning Joe has a very small audience. Its largest concentration is inside the Beltway. The second largest is in New York City. They've already got those people. The rest of the country, by and large, ignores it. You're dealing with a nation of 330 million people. You get 500 to 700,000 viewers. Right, so you're not dealing with a massive, massive audience, and literally nobody disagrees with you. So when you see things like them making the case crime isn't bad, or you know, Republicans are up, they're just trying to reinforce what they've already hammered home into the minds, or at least the cranial cavities, of the people they've already got. So when you hear Joe Scarborough talk about how bright Joe Biden is, there's no giant swath of undecided voters or moderate American voters who are watching Morning Joe. They just don't exist. He is trying to convince the converted to it. And it's a testament, really, if you think about it, to just how bad it is for Joe Biden, not Scarborough. Just, it's bad enough for Joe Scarborough. He goes home with Mika. He lives with Mika. He works with Mika. He can't get away. He's lousy with Mika. It's hard. He's a guy who likes to get out, socialize, you know, get to know the interns, that kind of thing. And it's an inside joke. But he can't because his wife is there. The only break he gets is when she goes to New York or she has to have some recovery time after whatever the latest procedure was. But that's mean. Gotta mean. But anyway, when Joe Scarborough is trying to convince the audience that Joe Biden is the smartest he's ever been, he's whip smart, and man, he's wonderful and everything, the audience he's trying to convince are committed leftists who watch MSNBC, which tells you how frightened the left is. And remember, Joe Biden talks to Joe Scarborough almost on a daily basis, Politico reported. He listens to the president whine and complain about the negativity of the press coverage that he gets. And it's like the most negative press coverage he gets from the leftist media is he won't do any press conferences, maybe occasionally, which the president could easily do. Just go, I'm going to do a press conference. But every chance he has to ask or answer questions from the media, he grabs the microphone and says, I asked for questions, but I don't want to get in trouble. Which is just this side of that guy in the POW camp in Vietnam from the famous footage where he's blinking and like, oh, it must be the lights are too bright for him. No, he was blinking Morse code for torture. And like, that's Joe Biden. And like, it's a cry for help. Like, I would ask for questions, but I don't want to get in trouble. Like, what is Jill just sitting off stage with a cat of nine tails going, I'm coming for you, old man. If you take one question, you go deviate from the script at all, we are going to get the red hot pokers out. We are going to get the bamboo shoots out. So he talks to Joe, who then by proxy tells us, man, this guy's the smartest guy the world has ever known. I don't know if he's trying to convince his audience or trying to convince himself, but he knows, or his agent. He's trying to convince the higher-ups over at MSNBC. Look at how good of a dog I can be. Add another zero to my check. The health insurance doesn't cover cosmetic surgery. Mika's breaking us. God, I mean. Here's Joe vouching for Joe.
But comparing that guy's mental state, I've said it for years now. He's cogent. Mm-hmm. But I undersold him when I said he was cogent. He's far beyond cogent. In fact, I think he's better than he's ever been. Intellectually, analytically, because he's been around for 50 years. And, you know, I don't know if people know this or not, Biden used to be a hothead. Sometimes that Irishman would get in front of the reasoning. Sometimes he would say things he didn't want to say. This is, and I don't really, you know what, I don't really care. Start your tape right now, because I'm about to tell you the truth. And F you if you can't handle the truth. This version of Biden, intellectually, analytically, is the best Biden ever. Not a close second. And I've known him for years. The Brzezinskis have known him for 50 years. If it weren't the truth, I wouldn't say it.
Yeah. You're known for telling the truth. Like, do you promise to forsake all others? Yeah, absolutely. This time. I mean, not the other two times I promised that. But this time, mostly because this woman won't leave me alone. Oh, the Brzezinskis have known her for 50. Yeah, okay, the Brzezinskis aren't exactly character witnesses. This really, it's like Britney Spears vouching for somebody's intelligence. Take my word for it. They're totally smart and stuff. Okay. I'm still going to have my questions. I'm still going to harbor my doubts. It's the smartest Joe I've ever. Well, it's not a tough race to win, if we're being honest here. A cognizant Joe for, he used to be a hothead. He's still a hothead. We've had stories from Politico, even friendly outlets, talking about how staff is afraid of him because he gets angry and starts yelling at them randomly, mostly because he's confused as to what's going on. But he does. He still gets mad and yell at them. You idiots, you don't know anything. But it was the Barack Obama's former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who said that Joe Biden has been wrong on every foreign policy issue for the last 30 years. Right? It was Barack Obama himself who never underestimate Joe Biden's ability to F things up. That's not a right-wing conspiracy. That's the left themselves. But don't worry, Joe Scarborough, honest broker. I mean, if you get past the infidelity in his other marriages, is a totally honest broker, a wonderful man, a family man. Just which family? Still sort of an open question, but that's beside the point. Don't be so judgy. Joe vouches for him, and when you think honest and integrity, you think Joe Scarborough, do you not? Why, you couldn't have a better character witness for anybody now that Charles Manson has died. Wait, what? No, never mind. Forget that. This is the Democratic Party. This is the best that they can come up with. This is who they are. This is who these people are. Since we're talking about MSNBC, let's go to Joy Reid for a second. This, the video or audio of Ginger Goebbels talking and joking about, oh, illegal aliens, blah, blah, blah. What crime? What crime? I live in Virginia. Stop worrying. And like, yeah, 2 weeks ago, a 14-year-old was abducted and raped by an illegal alien. And she didn't care. But there was more to that clip. More to that clip. This is getting more attention now from Joy Reid. Everything is about race with Trump voters. Don't you get it? You're voting against your interests because you're so damned racist that you just can't stand the idea of brown people getting anything. And it, well, let her explain. It's too stupid to paraphrase.
They're voting on race. They're voting on this idea of an invasion of brown people over the border. The idea that they can't get whatever job they want. A black person got it. Therefore, drive all the blacks out of the colleges. Get rid of DEI. That is what they're voting on. They're just voting specifically on racial animus. Which, at this stage, it isn't about economics.
No, which is why Trump killed the immigration bill.
Correct.
That's why. And because otherwise, he can't run against the other and brown people and people who don't look like him. Like his supporters, his base of supporters coming across the border and scaring people and killing people or whatever he's threatening out there.
They live in an insulated world, and apparently oxygen doesn't get in. Seems to have deprived their what used to be gray matter. I hate to call it a brain. It seems to have deprived them of their ability to nourish it. And so you get garbage like this. And there's this idea, and it's been a staple on the left since the 90s, I think. There was a book written called What's the Matter with Kansas? And the whole theory is written by a lefty. And the whole theory behind it was that Republicans were too stupid to realize what's in their own best interest. And they were voting against their own best interest. And the argument is basically that liberals create all sorts of welfare programs, government programs, give people money, give out money, and that's in your interest. If you vote for somebody who isn't going to give you money, that's voting against your interest. Now, let's just use Joy Reid's race obsession for a second. And if you look at the black vote, which has gone 90-95% to Democrats, in Democrat-controlled areas that are majority-minority, where Democrats have absolutely nothing standing in their way. There's not even a Republican speed bump in the last 50 years. Where is the economic policy of creating a gigantic entangling welfare state? Where's it worked out? Baltimore? But no. Even the Republican governors who have occasionally lucked their way into Annapolis haven't really interfered with Baltimore's downward spiral. Detroit, same thing. Destruction. Devastation. Chicago, complete and total Democrat control. They can control the city of Chicago, can control the state of Illinois. It's that powerful that machine is. Where has it worked out? Not anywhere. It's been a complete and total disaster. So you're sitting there and you're saying a whole bunch of people won't vote for the same policies that ruined all of these once great American cities? And somehow that's voting against their interest. And you sit there and it shows a fundamental lack of understanding of the American mindset that you have to and you should look to government to provide you with things. Government has to give you. Government must give. There's government benefits out there and you're not voting for it. You're voting against your interests. They don't understand that most people just want to be left the hell alone by government. That most people don't look at the Kardashians and go, God, they don't deserve it. I want to live like that. Most people like going to their jobs. The blue-collar people that I grew up with, they like going to their jobs. All they ask out of life is that they be able to afford their lives. They got a house that somebody like Joy Reid would not be caught dead in visiting, let alone living in, should be disgusted to live there, wouldn't sit on their couch, wouldn't go in their neighborhood. She'd roll up the windows and lock the doors and tell her driver to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible. But what they really want is just to be able to spend time with their family, with their friends, have enough money to put a steak on the table every once in a while, buy a beer, have some friends over, grill, go to a lake in the summer. You don't need to go to Paris on vacation or take a luxury cruise or rent a yacht or any. No, you just go camping. When I was a kid, our vacation was camping. Camping. We would spend a week in Mayo, Michigan, at the campgrounds there. Why? because it was $1 a day for the lot. That was it. We could have, I didn't know that was all we could afford, but we had a blast. Why? Because it was fun. We made the fun. Most people don't want to, I need to go to the, they'd take it if you gave it to them. But I didn't know I wasn't living large. I didn't know I was missing out on things because I wasn't. Because it was about the time, not the place. It wasn't about the money. But the politics of envy is where liberalism really metastasizes throughout people. Sort of the destructive force of a lot of this reality TV show shows you how other people live. And social media, the corrosion of society in social media. Look at how other people live. It's not fair that they're flying private. It's not fair that they're doing this, that, and the other thing. A lot of people look at that and get jealous and want government to do something about it. But the vast majority of people look at it and go, actually, the vast majority of people don't even bother looking at it. They're too busy living their lives. Which group of people do you think are more well-adjusted and happier? Not the MSNBC viewers. That's what the left doesn't understand about flyover country, about America, about blue-collar Americans, is we don't want stuff handed to us. We're not interested. Government needs to do something. Government needs to help me. No, just leave us alone. Get out of our way and let us do it. Not everybody wants to be a billionaire. Would we take it? Sure. Not everybody wants to be a millionaire or a billionaire. Most people just like living their lives and want to be left the hell alone. But the Joy Reads of the world and the leftists out there voting against your interests. Really? You seem like a real miserable piece of crap. And I'm happy. So what is my interest? What is your interest? All right? I don't think that we have the same interests in mind. You're a race-baiting piece of garbage, whereas I'm somebody who's just hanging out with friends and family and, you know, having a good time, enjoying the ride that we only get to do once. Whose interests are being served? You want me to serve your interests. You want me to vote your way to serve your interests, to either feed your God complex or your need for power or whatever it is. And people keep refusing to do it. And the people who refuse to give them their way are their enemy. There's no effort to convince anybody. They're just, you're not voting for your interests. Really? Why are you so miserable, you pile of garbage? And I mean that in the nicest possible way. All right, I really do believe that the left just doesn't understand Americans. It's the fact that people just mostly want to be left alone. You look at it and you go, what about this, that, and the other thing? What about, it's unfair. Some people have so much and... What most people want is enough, right? They want enough. They want to be able to pay for their stuff. They're nice every once in a while. They have a little bit extra, go a little crazy or whatever. Upgrade your beer choice. But while everybody would sure like to be a millionaire or a billionaire, very few people let it consume them. If you see, use my kids as an example. We can make this analogy on the fly. My daughter, Quinn, is very grateful when you give her something or whatever, but she's also very aware of what she doesn't have when you give her something. If there's a doll set or something, and there's five different dolls, you say, or there's a movie with, like the Trolls movie. I had to go suffer through the Trolls movie with them. The Trolls movie, and you buy the troll doll sets, and... And he's like, well, this is great. There's the three lead troll figures from it. She'll then go, well, you know, where's the fourth troll doll? Where's the fifth? What about this one? She's acutely aware of what she doesn't have. It's something we're working hard to sort of break her of, to let her get her to appreciate. She does appreciate it, and I'm not trying to make her sound like she's ungrateful or anything. But she is kind of... She loses focus on what she has in hand because she becomes acutely aware of what she doesn't have by comparison. I suppose it's natural. Maybe it's part of the culture. I don't know. I can't remember if I was that way or not. I doubt it. I was a great kid. Yeah. But it's that kind of way. That's how leftists are. They're not really grateful for what they have. They don't want people to be grateful for what they have. They want people to be jealous of what they don't have. See, if you're grateful for what you have, you run risk of being content, feeling good. That is the enemy of the left. That is the antithesis of the left. It is the politics of envy. It is the politics of jealousy. It's unfair that this person has that. It's unfair. It's class warfare. The millionaires and the billionaires. The this, the that's, and the other things. But it's not really unfair. It's unfair that Bill Gates is so rich. Now, it might be unfortunate that Bill Gates is so rich, considering what he does with his money and the destructive force that he's become and the fact that Windows sucks and all that, but that's beside the point. You didn't start a company in your garage and drop out of Harvard and risk everything and take the chances that he did. And like, I'm not a fan of Windows. I do use Word, but I'm not a fan of Windows or Microsoft in general, but you got to give it to them. They did it. He took the risks. He should get the reward. I don't sit there and go, it's unfair that he does the... Well, I've never started a major company that is worth billions of dollars. Have you? And oh, by the way, if it had gone under, he'd have been screwed, right? Like if it had gone under, he would have been worth nothing. If it didn't work out, if he didn't put in 80, 90-hour weeks, it wouldn't have worked, and nobody would know who Bill Gates is. Oh, Bill Gates is the guy that works the security gate at the parking lot? That's Bill Gates? Yeah, no, I know Bill. Decent guy. Kind of dumpy-looking, bad haircut, leers at women an awful lot. But, you know, he seems okay, contained in that box. That's what he'd be, or something there similar. But he took the risk. He should get the rewards. Most people recognize that. And most people recognize that they're not taking the risk. But if you fall prey to the politics of envy, which Democrats push constantly, well, then it's different. Then you are entitled to somebody else's fruits of somebody else's labor. Which is weird because I promise you the people who are the most infected and use the politics of envy the most are the least charitable. It's a very bizarre sort of fact when you look at it. The leftists, they always have these studies. They don't do them very often because the results are always unpleasant. But when they do them, they find that conservatives give way more to charity than liberals do. You go back and you look and you remember Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, remember her writing off his underwear, like the tax deductions. We gave old clothes to Goodwill, and they wrote off everything down to old pairs of Bill Clinton's underwear. And they didn't give that much. Now, they weren't swimming in cash, but they didn't give a high percentage of their money to, or really any percentage of their money to charity. Joe Biden, rather hysterically, in 2008, when he was running for vice president and released his tax returns finally, it showed that he'd given like less than $2,000 to charity, like charitable deduction. You don't even have to give cash. You give whatever, a box of stolen classified documents and claim that it's worth $10,000. Whatever you got laying around the garage, a couple of piles of Hunter's crack and take the deduction for it. But his charitable donations were less than $1,000 or $2,000 a year. He gave next to nothing. Now, this is a guy who, by that point, had purchased an estate, not just a house, not a mansion, an estate that was owned by the DuPont family in Delaware. He lived in one of the most prestigious, exclusive, large estates in the whole state. He had spent almost 40 years as a United States senator at that time, making well above the national average of salaries, and he barely gave anything to charity. He always bragged about how poor he was. He wasn't poor. He was poor relative to... That's like being I'm the shortest guy on my NBA team. Well, you're still probably like 6'7", right? I was the poorest member of the Senate. Most senators are worth $40, $50, $100 million, all right? You weren't missing any meals, Joe. You were doing all right, and your family was shoveling money your way, too. And where were they? No, go down that can of worms, but you get the point. Nobody was looking, so he gave nothing or next to nothing. And when they did give something, they made damn sure to take the deductions for it. But then when you talk to these leftists, it's a different mindset between conservatives and liberals. Walk down the street, a liberal walks down the street, sees a homeless person and says, man, somebody should do something about that. Government should do something about that. Whereas a conservative, if somebody's hungry, maybe they'll buy them a sandwich. Maybe they'll give them money. That's a moral hazard I would advise against. But maybe I've bought plenty of homeless people sandwiches. It's a different mindset altogether. If you want, they view paying taxes as charity. It's not charity. Charity doesn't come with, hey, give to the Salvation Army, the guy ringing the bell outside the Walmart. Give to him or face 5 years in prison plus massive fines and penalties that accrue retroactively at an interest rate that you can't afford. Okay, that's not charity. It always bothers me when I go to some event or something and there's the ticket price. And like it's a charitable thing, like suggested donation, $15 to get in. Okay, it's a suggested donation. So if I give you five, I can get in? Well, no. Why don't you just say it's $15 to get in? It's not a donation. It's the charge. It's the price. It's more of a semantical thing. And being somebody who works in words, word abuse bothers me. So it always has. It is a suggested donation. It's not a suggested donation, right? It's like a prison. These are the suggested boundaries. Oh, really? They're just suggested. No fences. We just put chalk down. Oh, okay. But if you step past the chalk, they're going to shoot you dead. Oh, well, it's a little more than a suggestion then, don't you think? Just saying. But they don't understand the American mindset, these liberals. And it's because most of them are either conditioned to look to the government for good things. And that's why I think it's evil, it's pernicious, it's wrong to the school lunch and breakfast program, not because I want to starve kids, but because I want parents to be forced to do something for their kids, right? Show their kids that they care. And instead, if you get your breakfast and your lunch and sometimes even your dinner and it's year-round from your school, from government, then you begin to look to government to take care of other things. You grow up in public housing. Well, then housing is supposed to be provided by the government, right? That's what housing, clothing, well, it's supposed to be provided by the food, it's supposed to be provided by the government. You become conditioned. They don't have to preach it to you. You just pick it up. It's like walking in a room full of smokers. You don't smoke, you're getting a bunch of secondhand smoke, and you're going to come out stinking like a lit pack of Marlboros. It just happens. The rest of America, the evil part that the left hates, don't fall for that. They don't go that route. They see the pratfalls. Is there anybody aside from elected officials and members of the elite media who you can point to who is a success story, who has government programmed their way to success? Is there anybody like that at all? Maybe Honey Boo Boo or her mom or something. But you get the point. There's nobody like, wow, look at that. There's a story. There are certain people, certainly a lot of people, who have started off on government programs or needed government programs at various points of their time. I'm all in favor of a safety net. I don't want it to become a hammock. But those people got off of it. They were not successful until they got off the government programs. Unless you commit massive welfare fraud. But it's a different mindset. It's a different way of looking at things. And the left doesn't want you to succeed. They want you to tread water. They want you to be just enough. And they're going to teach you how to tread water. They're not going to teach you how to swim. And they sure as hell are not going to invite you up on the deck. It's a difference between the right and the left. Let's go to John Kerry here for a second, because this is just hilarious. You talk about the corrupt left. John Kerry's whole life now is about climate change and getting Joe Biden reelected. Climate change, climate change, we need to put, you can't afford your electric bill anymore, but we need to do more. We need to do climate change. Oh, the electric grid is being strained because we're not producing enough electricity and we're trying to mandate everybody buy an electric car, but it's for the best. It's for climate change, blah, blah. But meanwhile, you know he's got generators at every one of his mansions. He's probably got a team of illegal aliens set to ride bicycles tied up to a generator to run, tied up to a turbine to power his house. He's married a billionaire. He was already worth hundreds of millions himself, so he's not hurting. And it's really easy to be magnanimous when you don't have to make choices about things. But in his obsession with climate change, it got really bizarre yesterday when he's talking about Russia. Now, right now, Russia is invading Ukraine. Russia, bad. We want Russia out of Ukraine, or so I thought. But John Kerry doesn't seem to... I don't think he'd care if Russia took Ukraine if they bought carbon offsets to cover the CO2 that they would release into the atmosphere on their way to Kiev. I'm only slightly exaggerating because of the absurdity of the situation. Listen to John Kerry.
I believe that Russia has the ability to be able to make enormous changes if it really wanted to. I mean, if Russia has the ability to wage a war illegally and invade another country, they ought to be able to find the effort to be responsible in the climate issue. Unfortunately, because of the actions that Russia took in an unprovoked, illegal war against another nation, we have not been engaged in discussions with Russia. Sadly, I say sadly because it's a loss for the world not to be able to have Russia acting constructively on this issue. But we need every country, including Russia. Russia is one of the largest emitters in the world. If Russia wanted to show good faith, they could go out and announce what their reductions are going to be and make a greater effort to reduce emissions now. And maybe that would open up the door for people to feel better about what Russia is choosing to do at this point in time.
Don't you love that? Look, if they decided to go to war, not cool. Not cool, bro. But I tell you, if Russia would just go ahead and announce what they're willing to do as far as like offsetting their invasion of Ukraine, then maybe some of the world will feel a lot better about what they've chosen to do. You're talking about an invasion of Ukraine, right? People, you ready to feel a lot better about it? Here's what we'll do. We'll turn off all the heat to our prisons in Siberia for 2 months, okay? There we go. That'll more than offset. All right, well, then good luck to you in Ukraine. Now that we're even, we're square, actually, we might owe you some CO2. How dense do you have to be? How insulated a life do you have? Now, John Kerry's led an insulated life. He again, he volunteered for the rear guard for Vietnam, got a Purple Heart for cutting himself shaving, came back a hero, announced himself to be a leader of the anti-war movement, threw somebody else's medals over a fence, kept his. In protest, oh, here go my medals. I'm like, oh, yeah, but not mine. I mean, mine in the universal sense, in the royal mind sense. Got elected to Congress, married a multimillionaire, divorced her to marry a billionaire, and then ran for president, failed miserably, but managed to fail up again and is now the climate czar. He's left government finally. He was Secretary of State under Obama. He's left government now to run to be one of the top dogs at Joe Biden's reelection campaign. You sit there and you go, when your biggest stress in life in your professional career is, geez, I might get a paper cut, you are out of touch. It eventually catches up to you. It eventually catches up to you at a time when you're trying to, say, for example, convince the American public that the economy is hell, as they tried to do in 2004, that George W. Bush is out of touch, things are awful, and then you go windsurfing on vacation during the campaign. You're windsurfing. Like, really? Who's out of touch with the average American? They don't have any idea. It all goes back to they have no idea who the average American is. What John Kerry said there on its face is laughable and absurd, and it's sort of an, oh my God, what in the hell is wrong with this guy kind of moment. But in the circles in which John Kerry rolls, there's nothing controversial about that. There are people, tens of thousands of people have been slaughtered over there in Ukraine, which has really helped lower the carbon emissions from those people, but it's not enough. It's not enough. We need to offset the artillery shells. And until we do that, but if Russia told us they had a plan for doing that, why, we might be able to forgive them and just give them the Donbas region. You sit there and you go, these people can't be for real, but they are all too real. You can have Joe going, well, Joe Biden is the smartest he's ever been. My God, he's whip smart. He is the greatest, most on it person ever. No, but you're out of touch. They don't understand. You're voting against your interests. You have no idea what my interests are. If I were wandering the hall of your doorman building, you would immediately call security, suspecting that somehow I slipped past the doorman, right? Hey, there's some weird kind of guy with long hair, and a big guy down the hall. Will you need to send somebody? I don't think he belongs here. It's weird. They always become everything they accuse everybody else of doing when it impacts them. The police, forget the police. Oh, wait, they're robbing our voters? We'll send in the National Guard. You guys shut up about it. We'll defund the police in places not here. We'll defund the police here. Oh, wait, it's impacting poor black communities? Who cares? Wait, it's impacting wealthy liberal communities? All right, well, quickly get the helicopters warming up. We need to dispatch the troops ASAP. It's not hypocrisy. It's beyond hypocrisy. They don't even hide it. Like, a hypocrite will recognize that they're being a hypocrite and go, well, I hope they don't notice. These people just do it. They don't care if you notice. They don't care. The people they interact with, the people they really genuinely care about, don't give a damn. So they don't care if you notice. Okay, let us shift our gears and our focus a little bit to the north and a little bit to the west. Seattle, San Francisco too. I went to Seattle when I was a kid. Just drove through it with the parents. We had dinner there. It was back on our mega trip to California. Drove through the south and back through the north. Got to, I don't know, we hit 25, 30 states. Hit every tourist trap as you possibly could find. All the good stuff. It was awesome. National parks. It was great. We stopped or went through Seattle, and we had dinner. I remember, I vaguely remember the restaurant. It was a steakish house. But it was great. It was great. Got the hell out of there. Of course, that was before the rot of liberalism that had really taken hold of the city had gotten to the core. And I'm sure it was there, but it just wasn't a factor. Well, now the Democratic Socialists of America basically run it. The Antifa wing, they run it. They've got autonomous zones that pop up every once in a while, and then somebody dies, and they go, oh, you can't have the autonomous zone. You will let your kids go crazy and go ahead and play make. Oh, somebody died. We got to get in there. And it's not an overdose. Those happen all the time. It has to be somebody gets murdered. And they go, oh, all right, you silly rabbits, come on. Get out of there. We got to go in, clean up the needles and wipe off the blood, and then you can have your little autonomous zone back. Well, they are as you might imagine, as angry at the government now, the president of the United States now, who's changing his tune, by the way, on Israel, because of Israel. It's weird. Nobody's upset on the left about we're not calling for peace in Ukraine. Nobody's upset going, you know what, we need a ceasefire. Far more people have died in Ukraine than have died in Gaza. But it's two white people, two groups of white people fighting. They don't really care about that. Even though both groups of people in the Middle East are Middle Eastern, one is a Jew. They're de facto white when it's convenient for the left. So it's okay to hate them. And Palestinians, they're minorities. They're oppressed. It's white versus brown. And, of course, white is wrong in all cases and all things. Doesn't matter that Palestinians attacked. Doesn't matter how many people Palestinians have killed. It just, well, the perfect way to sum it up is it doesn't matter. It being whatever you got. They don't care. Well, the Democratic Socialists of America are joining the growing chorus of leftists who are saying we must vote in the primary for uncommitted. They want to send a whole bunch of uncommitted delegates to the convention to try and wreak havoc. That's why I'm hopeful is the wrong word, but it's also the right word. That's why I suspect that there will be mostly peaceful convention in Chicago, but also a lot of riots and violence because a bunch of radical leftists will be going there, and you get a bunch of radical leftists together. See, at the Republican convention, the radical leftists will be kept outside the gates because they put up these almost unscalable barricades in a very wide area, perimeter around a convention. It's a labyrinth to get into. But if the radical element are delegates, if the, you know, the call is coming from inside the house, that sort of thing, things can go sideways really quickly. You can keep people on one side of the fence out of the inside because of the fence. But if you've got people on both sides of the fence working to tear down that fence, well, then things get interesting, don't they? So they want to get as many people inside that fence as possible. They want to assign unassigned delegates, and they want to populate those with radicals, mostly so they can go inside and chant and scream and everything, if provided the administration by the time of the convention hasn't said, we hate Israel and we're going to give Hamas nuclear weapons. You know, it's possible, depending on the polling data. But anyway, the Democratic Socialists have a list of grievances with the Biden administration, and there's no different than the other. And then, of course, it all brings back to Republicans, because ultimately leftists, progressives are progressives first and foremost, and anything else a distant second. So for all their talk, they ultimately all bring it back home.
We have been out in the streets in our thousands and in our millions, yet the devastation continues and our desperation grows. Overwhelmingly, Americans, both Democrat and Republican, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, are clear that they want a ceasefire and they want peace. But right now, we do not have a candidate for president who speaks for us. That is why we are voting uncommitted delegate on the ballot. Because handing over our primary vote to President Biden, while he throws billions and billions of our tax dollars to bombing innocent people, while millions of Americans can barely afford groceries and rent, while we are told that there is not enough money for affordable housing, healthcare, and education, this is simply not stomachable anymore. And let's be real. Voting uncommitted is our best chance at defeating Donald Trump and the vulgar, Islamophobic, racist, anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-immigrant, anti-trans, anti-women vision that he has for America.
All of a sudden, it takes a turn there at the end. Like, oh, by the way, Donald Trump is a monster. Like, what? You're listing off a list of grievances. I do love, we've been going to the streets in the thousands and millions. There's no way anywhere near a million people have gone to the streets to protest in favor of Hamas. Just nowhere near that. Like, there's a march with 10,000 people. You have any idea how much a million is? They don't care. They can just say it. But you got to admire the spunk. They're going to do this and do that and do the other thing, and we've got to make sure we blah, 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 and vote non-committed. It's the only way. The delusions of these people. The majority of Americans, Democrats, Republicans, want peace. Okay, yeah, no, given the choice, hey, do you want war or do you want peace? Everybody's going to go, most people will go, we want peace, obviously. But if you get into the nuance, it's something in the neighborhood of almost 70% of Americans support Israel and what they're doing. Why? Because we recognize that the terrorists in Hamas killed 1,200 people on one day who were minding their own business and going about their lives for the sin of simply being Jewish. Right? Well, that flies in progressive circles. It doesn't really fly with good human beings. And the vast majority of Americans are good human beings. So you can sit there and this is how the left always does it. They proclaim themselves to be operating at the behest of and in the interest of the majority of Americans. It's how you can sit there and scream, this is what democracy looks like. And you're like one of four people screaming that at the top of your lungs in a room full of a couple of hundred. Like, that's not what democracy looks like. You're using the douchebag veto to overrule the will of everybody else in the room. That's the exact opposite of what democracy is. That's one of your isms that you claim to dislike. But they're undeterred. I mean, they are the turd, but they are undeterred. They will not be bothered. They will not let the facts stand in the way of a good story, and they will simply insist on their will. They are the, philosophically, they are the date rapists. Otherwise, they were not going to take no for an answer. And they're going to insist all along that she wanted it. She totally wanted it. She did not want it. The American people are not with these people. But they insist that anybody group with the people in it, in their title, people's this or the people, never represents the people. They represent the left-wing agenda, period, plain and simple. All right, that is enough for today, I say. And this week, man, it is Friday. It's been a hell of a week. And if you want to hear the, I don't know if I can't promise I'll do the State of the Union reaction on the Week in Effing Review, or if I'll wait till Monday, or if I'll ever even talk about it at all. Because honestly, there's nothing this weirdo, mutant, brain dead psychopath is going to say that is going to matter in the grand scheme of things. Does it sound like I'm a little bit biased going into this thing? I might be a little bit biased going into this thing. Anyway, don't forget patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast or DerekHunter.locals.com. Please consider supporting the program. Or you can email me, DerekAllenHunter@gmail.com. You want to try a sample episode of it, or you want to shoot some support via PayPal, however you like to do it, all is appreciated. Have an awesome time. Go, whatever you're going to do, go do it and have some fun with it. Be back here the next time.